Picture this, if you will. You're a researcher in the late 1980s, at the beginning of a renaissance in genomic research. You're investigating a European family tree with an unusually high prevalence of failure to thrive and fatal pneumonias. On autopsy, their lungs revealed dilation and necrosis of major airways, and a startling amount of airway obstruction with thick, sticky mucus. You find that this complex phenotype is the result of just one gene mutation, the loss of function of a chloride ion channel found in exocrine glands. And you wonder to yourself, how does the loss of a single ion channel lead to such a complex disease process? Welcome back to AudioBricks, beautiful people. I'm Arjun Iyer, bringing some biochemistry knowledge from our bricks to your ears. After completing this section, you'll be able to 1. Define equilibrium and describe the forces at work on ions across a biological membrane. 2. Discuss the importance of the Nernst equation and of equilibrium potentials. 3. Describe the importance of the sodium-potassium ATPase in relation to the resting membrane potential. 4. Describe the non-equilibrium steady state. And 5. Define and discuss the chord conductance equation. Differences in ion concentration inside and outside a cell cause a difference in the charge of the intracellular and extracellular environments. This electrical polarization of a cell relative to its environment is referred to as the cellular membrane potential. And this potential serves as an energy source for a variety of cellular functions and as a way for excitable cells like muscle cells and neurons to communicate their signals. A cell controls its membrane potential by regulating the concentration of multiple ions and other charged particles. So let's take a closer look at the biochemistry behind cell membrane potential. Part 1. What is electrochemical equilibrium? All right, first things first. In order for there to be a comparative difference in charges, you have to have a barrier that's largely impermeable to charged particles. And that job, my friends, falls to the cell membrane, which consists primarily of a double layer of phospholipids. The phosphate heads are polar and thus interact with the water matrix of the human body. The heads of the inner layer are facing the cytoplasm, and the heads of the outer layer are facing the interstitium. And this leaves the hydrophobic tails in each layer interlocking and facing each other. And this nonpolar mesh of tails is the main reason for the barrier's ion impermeability. Remember from basic chemistry, charged particles are only able to pass through polar or hydrophilic membranes. But in order for an ion to cross the cell membrane, the cell has to use channels and pumps embedded in the membrane itself. Now, just because there's a barrier that can't be crossed doesn't mean that ions don't want to cross over to the other side. Okay, I'm anthropomorphizing a bit, but in technical terms, despite the presence of a barrier, there are certain forces that push ions towards one side of the membrane or the other. And the most important driving forces by far are the chemical and electrical gradients. Now, the principle of a chemical gradient refers to the fact that all ions, and for that matter molecules, are antisocial little buggers who can't stand to be close to others of their kind. Take potassium, for example. Chemically speaking, it doesn't mind any number of sodiums, chlorides, or magnesiums. But put it in a room with another potassium, and they're going to move to opposite corners of the room, face the wall, and the moment a door opens, one of them is going to try to get the hell out of there. Unless, of course, there's a whole room full of potassiums on the other side of the door. And this is what's meant by a gradient. When there's different concentrations of potassium on either side of the barrier, they preferentially diffuse away from the side with the high concentration and towards the side with the low concentration. And how badly they want to get from one side to the other depends on how big that difference in concentration is. In physics terms, this is represented by the chemical driving force, or F sub D. The principle of an electrical gradient, on the other hand, is much more generalizable. Opposites attract, likes repel. That's probably why I married someone quiet and polite, because if I married another loud, obnoxious human being like myself, we get sick of each other pretty quick. Probably end up murdering each other in our sleep. But in the case of ions, the only variations on the electrical theme are positive and negative charge. While potassium may consider chloride, sodium, and magnesium the same from a chemical point of view, from an electrical point of view, they couldn't be more different. Now, because potassium is positively charged, which ions is it most likely to be attracted to? Sodium, chloride, or magnesium? Potassium will be attracted to the negatively charged chloride, repelled from the positively charged sodium, and take off running in the opposite direction if confronted by magnesium with its double positive charge. And on either side of the cell membrane, the different concentrations of cations and anions give rise to a net electrical gradient. More positive charges exist outside the cell than on the inside. So by convention, we say that from the perspective of the cell, there is a net negative resting membrane potential. And the larger the difference in charged particles, the more negative the resting membrane potential, and the larger the electrical driving force pulling cations into the cell or pushing anions out of the cell. In physics terms, the electrical driving force is represented as F sub E. Remind me what the chemical driving force is again? F sub D, just making sure you're keeping everything straight. Now, whether our friend potassium wants to move inside or outside the cell depends primarily on the relative values of the chemical and electrical driving forces. In physics terms, the sum of F sub D and F sub E is the net force, or F net, that quantifies the force with which an ion pushes to get across the cell's membrane, or pulls back to stay on the cytoplasmic side. And the dual impact of the electrical and chemical gradients that creates this F-net is commonly referred to as the electrochemical gradient. So, what do we call it when F-net equals zero? When F-net equals zero, we say the ion is at equilibrium. It has no particular desire to move to one side or the other. Now, that's not to say there's no movement. It just means that push equals pull, so the flow in is equal to the flow out. But hey, enough of my jibber-jabber. Time for a knowledge check. What forces act on an ion to influence its movement across the cell membrane? So you have the chemical driving force, created by the concentration gradient across the membrane, and the electrical driving force, created by an electrical gradient across the membrane. And these are the two primary determinants of how strongly an ion wants to move into or out of the cell. Part 2. How do we know if an ion is at electrochemical equilibrium? The Nernst equation. Alright guys, fun part's over. Not gonna stop pretending like ions are just crazy critters with social anxiety disorder, because it's time to cover a crazy complicated equation straight from the land of nightmares. Say hello to the Nernst equation.
Equation alert.
I stole that one from Ed Barnes. So anyway, the Nernst equation goes something like this. The membrane potential at an ion's equilibrium equals the quantity R times temperature over the quantity ion charge times F, all times the natural logarithm of the quantity extracellular over intracellular ion concentration. So all you have that memorized now, right? Just kidding. But for those of you who need to see it written out, your podcast player should be displaying the equation right now. But unless you're planning to be a physicist, you're probably more interested in what this equation represents and how it applies to human physiology. Here's what you really need to know. Equilibrium exists when the electrical driving force equals the chemical driving force. All the Nernst equation does is represent that equality. On the left side of the equation, you have the membrane potential V, representing the electrical gradient and thus the electrical driving force. On the right side, you have the term RT over ZF. Most of these are just constants, but the most important term is Z, which stands for the charge. Since Z is in the denominator on the right side, it serves as a multiplier to the electric potential if carried to the left side. And this does two things. First, it tells you that the positivity or negativity of the charge alters the direction of the electrical driving force, which I'm sure you could have guessed. By convention, since a negative membrane potential means that the cytoplasm is negative compared to the extracellular fluid, if V times Z is positive, it implies that the electrical driving force pushes ions out of the cell. But it also tells you that the impact of the membrane potential increases as the absolute charge on the ion increases as well. For example, assuming a resting membrane potential of negative 60, the electrical driving force pulling the double positive magnesium towards the cytoplasm will be double the driving force pulling the single positive sodium towards the cytoplasm. The second term on the right side of the equation is the natural logarithm of the quantity extracellular over intracellular ion concentration. Now, this is the term that represents the concentration gradient, and by that token, the chemical driving force. And again, there's two things to remember here. First, the core of this term is the ratio extracellular over intracellular ion concentrations, and extracellular is in the numerator. So what does it mean if the ratio of extracellular to intracellular ion concentrations equals 1? That's right. The concentrations are the same on both sides of the membrane. Values greater than 1 mean that the concentration is greater outside the cell, and the chemical driving force will push ions into the cell. Values less than 1 mean that the concentration is greater on the inside of the cell, and the driving force pushes ions out of the cell. Now, for those of you who freak out when you see a natural logarithm, stop trying to remember what E is, reboot your brains, and come back when you're ready. The only reason the natural logarithm function is used is because when you take the natural logarithm of 1, you get 0. Which makes sense, right? If the extracellular and intracellular concentrations are equal, there should be 0 chemical driving force. The natural logarithm function also accounts for the positive and negative directions, just like with the electrical driving force. If the ratio becomes greater than 1, you get positive values that start off increasing quickly, then increase more slowly. If the ratio becomes less than 1, then you get negative values. For anyone learning about formulas in a medical context, don't just try to memorize the formulas. It's way too easy to forget specifics, like what goes on in the numerator versus the denominator. Instead, work on understanding the relationships between the variables, the proportions, how they tend to increase or decrease. Ultimately, these are going to be what actually helps you apply these principles. So here's a quick knowledge check. What does the Nernst equation represent? The Nernst equation is at its core a statement of equality between the electrical driving force and the chemical driving force. Therefore, it describes the relationship between the membrane potential, ion charge, and the concentrations inside and outside the cell. Right now, some of you are wondering why the ion charge Z is on the right side of the equation, along with the stuff representing the chemical driving force. Well, I mean, it's an equation, so you can really write it however you want. If it helps you to remember it as V times Z equals blah 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 blah, that's also correct. But the way the Nernst equation is conventionally written, the membrane potential at equilibrium is isolated to one side. And ultimately, solving for the equilibrium potential of a given ion allows us to apply these concepts to human physiology. Part 3. How is the Nernst equation used in medical physiology? All right, fair warning, guys. This section deviates a lot from what's actually in the brick. In the bricks, it basically goes through how you solve for equilibrium potential. And if I tried to do that on this podcast, I'd probably get kicked off of Apple Podcasts within a week. And honestly, most of you aren't going to be actually plugging numbers into the Nernst equation, either in your careers or on a test. On this podcast, we're going to be going over broad strokes, focusing on the biomedical applications of these principles. As we mentioned before, the Nernst equation is a statement of equality between the chemical and electrical driving forces, implying electrochemical equilibrium. And it's conventionally written in a way that isolates the membrane potential to the left side of the equation, so that you can solve for it. But remember, the premise of the Nernst equation is that the ion you're solving for is at equilibrium. So if you plug in values for potassium, the potential you're solving for is actually a hypothetical membrane potential at which potassium would be at electrochemical equilibrium. So we call this value potassium's equilibrium potential. If we plug in typical values for potassium's extracellular and intracellular concentrations, its charge of positive 1, and the body temperature in Kelvin, we get an equilibrium potential of minus 88 millivolts. Only problem is, potassium doesn't get to unilaterally decide what the membrane potential of a cell is. There are literally dozens of charged ions and molecules, each with their own concentration gradients and charges, that contribute to the membrane potential. That's why potassium's equilibrium potential is only a hypothetical value. It's basically like saying potassium would prefer it if the membrane potential were minus 88 millivolts. The good news is that the actual membrane potential is a measurable quantity, and in most cells, it's around minus 60 millivolts. Okay, boo-hoo, so potassium didn't get the exact voltage it wanted. Big whoop. That's actually closer to ideal than most ions usually get. The question is, what's potassium going to do about it? To answer that question, you take the difference between the actual membrane potential and the ion's equilibrium potential. Just to make sure you're still awake, what's negative 60 minus negative 88 millivolts? It's positive 28 millivolts, meaning that the actual membrane potential is 28 millivolts more positive than potassium wants it to be. Now, think back to the last section. Does a positive electric potential mean the inside or the outside of the cell is more positive? Remember that the membrane potential is by convention expressed from the perspective of the cytoplasm. So the cytoplasm is 28 millivolts more positive than potassium quote-unquote wants it to be at its current concentration gradient. So, here's the crucial question. If somebody opened up a bunch of potassium channels in the cell membrane, would those antisocial little potassiums preferentially exit the cell or enter the cell? Because potassium is a positive ion, and the inside of the cell is too positive for potassium's comfort, the moment you open up the membrane channels, potassium is going to get the hell out of that cell. And you can do the same calculations to come up with an equilibrium potential for all major ions at physiologic concentrations to determine whether the actual membrane potential is relatively positive or negative compared with the ion's equilibrium potential. Couple things to remember, though. First, charge matters when it comes to this relative value. To give you an example, the actual membrane potential is too positive for potassium's preferred equilibrium, but too negative for chloride's equilibrium at physiologic concentrations. Yet both of them will preferentially exit the cell, since the positively charged potassium wants to escape the relatively positive intracellular charge, and the negatively charged chloride wants to escape the relatively negative intracellular charge. I know, right? Mind blown. What's more, the farther away the membrane potential is from the ion's equilibrium potential, the greater the force with which those ions push to get to the other side. And here's why this matters. If you're trying to get an ion to move along its electrochemical gradient, all you do is open up a channel. But if you're trying to move an ion where it doesn't want to go, the amount of energy you have to expend doing that is proportional to how far away from equilibrium the ion already is. But hey, before we pull the transporters into this, let's take a moment to review. If bicarbonate's equilibrium potential is less than the actual membrane potential, and you open up a bunch of bicarbonate channels in the membrane, is bicarbonate going to leave or enter the cell? Pause if you need a second to think about this. If bicarbonate prefers to be at a lower equilibrium potential than the actual membrane potential, that means that the membrane potential, and therefore the cytoplasmic charge, is more positive than bicarbonate is comfortable with. But since bicarbonate's negatively charged, it's going to enter the cell. Part 4. How does the sodium-potassium ATPase help maintain the resting membrane potential? In a universe where ions preferentially diffuse to equilibrium, some of the electrochemical gradients that exist across the barrier of cell membranes are honestly pretty crazy. There's about 10 times as much sodium outside the cell as inside, and almost 20 times as much potassium inside the cell as outside. Add the fact that most cells have a membrane potential of negative 60 millivolts, and you realize how very far away from equilibrium the cell really is. Maintaining this non-equilibrium steady state, as it's called, takes active work on the part of the cells, and in cells like neurons that regularly depolarize, maintaining this non-equilibrium steady state can take up a humongous fraction of the cell's energy output. One of the most important tools a cell uses to maintain its non-equilibrium steady state is the sodium-potassium ATPase, a pump embedded in the cell's membrane that uses energy from ATP to actively transport three sodium ions out of the cell while transporting two potassium ions into the cell. This is what's responsible for the huge difference in extracellular and intracellular concentrations of both ions, and the fact that three positive charges are sent out of the cell for every two brought in is a major contributor to the negative resting potential of the cell. And you might wonder why such a pump attempts to transport so many ions at once. First, if it's going to spend ATP, it better get all the bang for its buck, because that phosphate bond can only be spent as all or nothing. But second, while transporting ions two and three at a time is a huge disruption to the concentration gradients of sodium and potassium, replacing two of the three positive charges you remove from the cytoplasm actually creates less disruption for the electrical gradient. Life's neat, huh? But none of this answers the question, why does a cell put so much energy into maintaining a non-equilibrium steady state? Why expend all that energy just to cram ions in places they don't want to be? While there are certain cells like neurons and myocytes that have a specialized reason to depolarize and return to steady state, the majority of cells have a much simpler reason. If you'll recall, the difference between the membrane potential and an ion's equilibrium potential determines the force with which it pushes to get to the other side of the membrane. Some ions, like sodium, have an equilibrium potential that's way different from the membrane potential. While a membrane potential is generally around minus 60 millivolts, sodium's equilibrium potential is a whopping positive 60 millivolts. Now it's time to put your thinking caps on. What's the potential difference, and what does that say about where sodium will go if a channel opens up? The membrane potential, and by that token, the cytoplasm, is a full 120 millivolts more negative than sodium is comfortable with, meaning that given the opportunity, the positively charged sodium will push its way into the cell. And when you compare that 120 millivolts to the measly 28 millivolts of electric potential pushing potassium out of the cell, you realize exactly how much energy needs to be expended to maintain sodium's non-equilibrium steady state. Basically, if you open up the right channel, sodium will come flying in like a bat out of hell. But if you're a particularly clever cell, you can harness the potential energy of an ion moving down a strong electrochemical gradient to pump another ion requiring equal or lesser energy against its concentration gradient. It's a pretty gangster move, known as secondary active transport. The renal tubular cells use sodium co-transport effectively to scavenge every last bit of glucose, amino acids, and phosphate from the renal tubule, to the point where there's almost none left. Part 5. How do we quantify membrane potential? Okay, so far we've gone over the Nernst equation in nauseating detail. And as I'm sure you know by now, the Nernst equation solves for the equilibrium potential of a single ion. But the membrane potential is the result of not only the literally dozens of individual equilibrium potentials, but also the permeability of the membrane to each ion. And the equation that describes how each ion contributes to the overall membrane potential is called the chord conductance equation.
Equation alert.
No, wait, no. Stop, guys. Because this equation not only completely sucks, I'm 95% sure that none of you are ever going to have to use it. Like, ever. For those of you who are interested, it'll be viewable on your podcast player now, but here's all you need to know. The way you derive membrane potential is kind of like how you take a weighted average. Basically, you add up all the equilibrium potentials of the individual ions, multiplying each equilibrium potential by its relative weight, or how much its equilibrium potential contributes to the total. And the thing that determines how much an ion's equilibrium potential influences the membrane potential is the relative permeability of the membrane to that particular ion, otherwise known as its conductance. And this actually makes a lot of sense if you think about it. While each ion has a specific preference for its ideal membrane potential, the ions can only get to help dictate the membrane potential if they have the ability to cross the membrane and make their equilibrium preference a reality. And since ions can't actually cross the plasma membrane, more conductance means more open membrane channels that conduct the specific ion across to the side where it wants to go. To use the example from earlier, some ions like potassium have equilibrium potentials very close to the actual membrane potential, in part because most membranes have a lot of potassium leak channels. Some cells, like the contractile cardiac myocytes in the heart, have even more potassium channels than usual, and have resting membrane potentials of minus 90 millivolts, which is even closer than usual to the equilibrium potential of potassium at minus 88 millivolts. In contrast, sodium has a much lower conductance at rest, which is why its equilibrium potential is so far away from the membrane potential. The flow of sodium ions isn't great enough to allow sodium's preference to greatly influence the membrane potential as much as potassium. However, the fact that sodium is so prevalent and has such a strongly positive equilibrium potential means that it does substantially influence the membrane potential, just not as much as potassium. At the end of the day, the primary ions that influence membrane potential are sodium, potassium, chloride, and calcium. Final knowledge check, gang. According to the chord conductance equation, what two properties of an ion determine how much it influences a cell's resting membrane potential? The cell membrane's ion conduction, which is related to the permeability and the equilibrium potential of an ion, represented by V sub X. And that's a wrap. Hopefully my math-free version worked out for you. And just in case you're not sure, let's see if you were able to learn what you're supposed to. First, can you define the two primary forces that move ions across a cell membrane? Ions are acted on by both the chemical driving force, F sub D, and the electrical driving force, or F sub E. The chemical driving force is related to the concentration gradient of that particular ion on either side of the membrane, and the electrical driving force is related to the electric potential, or the relative positive and negative charge on either side of the membrane. By convention, the membrane's electrical gradient is expressed from the perspective of the cytoplasm, so a negative electrical gradient implies that the cytoplasm contains more negative charge than the extracellular space. Second, can you describe in loose terms what relationship the Nernst equation represents and the value it solves for by convention? Without getting too mathy, the Nernst equation describes an ion's equilibrium state. When the two forces F sub D and F sub E acting on an ion are equal, and there's no net movement of ions. The Nernst equation is arranged so that it solves for the membrane potential at an ion's equilibrium, otherwise known as the ion's equilibrium potential. Since ions prefer to diffuse until equilibrium is reached, you can think of the equilibrium potential as an ion's preferred membrane potential. Third, how does the relationship between the actual membrane potential and an ion's equilibrium potential affect the direction and magnitude of ion flow across a membrane? So to start off, if the membrane potential equals the ion's equilibrium potential, then the ion is, duh, at equilibrium. So in this case, the ions don't have any particular drive to move into or out of the cell. If the membrane potential is higher than the equilibrium potential, then the membrane potential, aka the cytoplasm, is too positive for the ion's liking. If the membrane potential is lower than the ion's equilibrium potential, then the cytoplasm is too negatively charged for the ion's liking. Easy enough. But here's the tricky part. Whether the ion moves into or out of the cell depends on the charge. Positive ions like to enter the cell when the cytoplasm is negative. Negative ions like to enter the cell when the cytoplasm is too positive. Finally, the difference between the equilibrium potential and membrane potential basically shows how far out of its comfort zone the ion is. And the greater the difference, the stronger the driving force that pushes the cell to cross the membrane. Next, can you define a non-equilibrium steady state? A cell creates a non-equilibrium steady state for ions in which the cell maintains a non-zero resting membrane potential while actively disturbing the equilibrium of multiple ions. And one of the main ways it does this is via the sodium-potassium ATPase. The purpose of this is to exploit the potential energy of the ion's electrochemical gradients. Finally, what are two variables that determine how any one ion's equilibrium potential contributes to the overall membrane potential? Each ion's equilibrium potential and conductance, a function of the membrane's permeability to the ion, determines its contribution to the overall membrane potential. And this relationship is described in the chord conductance equation, a huge monstrosity of an equation that you probably won't be responsible for memorizing. More important are the concepts I described above. Now, armed with your newfound knowledge, let's revisit our case from earlier and tackle the question, how does the loss of a single ion channel lead to such a complex disease process? You're a researcher who's recently discovered that the phenotype causing the hereditary failure to thrive, recurrent pneumonias, and airway mucus plugging can be traced back to a single loss-of-function mutation in a chloride ion channel found in exocrine glands. From previous bench research, you already know that the equilibrium potential of chloride is minus 47 millivolts. How do you explain this pathophysiology in the language of transmembrane ion transport? Since the chloride ion has an equilibrium potential greater than the actual membrane potential, around minus 60 millivolts, the cytoplasm is usually too negative for chloride at rest. Therefore, if chloride channels are open to the cell membrane, the negative chloride ion's tendency is to move away from the relative negative charge inside the cell into the extracellular space. You remember that chloride is the most prevalent extracellular osmole besides sodium. So in exocrine cells, the most important function of chloride efflux is the resulting osmosis of water out of these cells, diluting the secretions to the appropriate consistency. Losing the chloride channels causes the secretions to become thick and viscous, from the protective mucus in the airways to the bicarbonate-rich pancreatic juices in the digestive tract. And when these secretions become too viscous to move through the ducts they're supposed to, it leads to the multiple complications of the disease, known as cystic fibrosis. And that's our show. Hopefully you like my less mathy take on transcellular ion transport. If you did, make sure to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Remember, your feedback helps us improve. If you like to work through formulas, you can enjoy the Fulbright's experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already. Until next time, friends.